And more immediately, we have to see if we can finish at least these shlokas that are preliminary to the peopling of Globe D. It's interesting that HPB includes, under the general heading of Nature Unaided Fails, the shlokas from about 5 to 10. She does not include shloka 11, which really does belong with this series, and therefore I'm including it with this series. I want to take up today, however, with a statement which is found in shloka 7. You will recall that at this point in the preparatory stages of Globe D for the fourth round, the globe itself, with its own instinctual life, if we want to call it that, its own desire urges, it's because wherever there is life, wherever there is sentiency, even, there is also embedded in it its own desire nature. Reflective again of this tremendous principle which we saw in the cosmogonic process, that the moment there is any outward turning, in fact, even before that, there is within, if we may put it this way, the absolute. We can hardly say what is within the absolute because everything is within it. There is its own energy, its own dynamism, which in the cosmogonic process is referred to as Fohat. Well, we meet Fohat again and again, and you readily see why Fohat is my favorite character in the Secret Doctrine. He plays such an enormous role, and he is indeed my favorite character, as all of you by this time surely know. That reflects itself at every single level, this dynamism, this energy. And therefore, even in the preparatory stages of this globe for a new round, for a new development, in a very watery stage, if we want to call it that, a very almost amorphous stage, a kind of a stage of emulsion where it's sort of globbly. I don't know what else to say.
Globbish.
All right. There is this desire to produce form, and this appears to be the main emphasis always of this pull outwards, is a desire to produce form, some kind of form. I think we see this within ourselves even, that when we think something, when something occurs to us, we want to either verbalize it or draw a picture or bake a cake. We want some kind of shape to be produced, to take place, and we give it shape. And we even say this, we give shape to our thoughts and so on. And so the earth, the globe, has been struggling, and then there is attracted to it, again by a natural attraction, we can trace this through the cosmogonic processes, attracted to it those entities, those intelligences who are now to be responsible for its further development, its nurturing, its sustenance, and its further development. But they were displeased when they came. Our flesh is not there, because what is there, what is presented, are the forms out of all of the past. This is all the globe has to work with, is remnants of the past, and therefore has produced these watermen, terrible and bad. No fit rupa for our brothers of the fifth. Now it's that phrase that we really need to examine a bit. Our brothers of the fifth. It's an amazing phrase that is given there, because first of all, most importantly, what is indicated is that these intelligences who have come are intimately related, very intimately connected with the work that is going to be accomplished, that is, the inhabitants that are going to be present on this globe and therefore in this particular round. Our brothers. Notice that marvelous word immediately. I think we have to recognize, therefore, that there is this close interconnection of all intelligences throughout the system, and more particularly that these entities, these intelligences that have come, these dhyanis, from the bright father mother, from the white regions they came, from the abodes of the immortal mortals, our brothers. That is a very intimate, and Jeffrey Barborka emphasizes this very strongly, that a kinship, because of the close relationship between the two kingdoms, these dhyanis from the mortal-immortal region, the immortal-mortal regions from the moon chain, and those who are now to, well, our humanity, our whole human life wave. So we are indeed brothers with the whole hierarchy of intelligences. Now the important point, though, is that what is meant by the fifth, our brothers of the fifth? And this, I think, needs a little study, and I think we must recognize what it deals with. Barborka, in Peopling of the Earth, examines this phrase very, very closely. And he points out, on pages 116 and 117, five things that it cannot mean. That it cannot mean. It cannot mean the monads who will be undertaking the fifth round, because this is obviously the fourth round, and that is emphasized. It's interesting, HPB does not, in her commentary, indicate why it's the brothers of the fifth, which is us, you see. Why the fifth? Well, it can't be the fifth round. I mean, that is quite obvious, and we have to agree with Barborka on that point very definitely, because throughout she has said this is the fourth round. Then the words, Barborka says, cannot be applied to the fifth globe of the Earth's planetary chain, because the very first words, of course, indicate, of the stanza, indicate the law which turns the fourth. And of course, again and again, she's been very definite that this is the fourth globe of the chain, the middle globe. So it can't be the fifth globe. And then he says it can't be used to describe the fifth root race. Well, that's perfectly obvious, because we haven't even gotten the first root race going yet, you see. So it obviously can't be the fifth root race. Could it relate, he says, to the fifth kingdom, the superhuman kingdom? Well, it can't, because the human kingdom is very obviously either the fourth or, if you wish, more properly, the seventh kingdom. That is to say, if you start with mineral, vegetable, and animal, we are the fourth kingdom. But more properly, because there are three previous life experiences which we call through elemental kingdoms preceding these, we are really the seventh, with three Dhyanchahanic kingdoms to come, making a total of 10, which is the perfect number. So it can't be the fifth kingdom. Can it be that it applies to the fifth principle, manas, the mind principle? This really, again, Barborka feels, however, while he says it's plausible, he feels it's unacceptable, because it requires one round for the full development of one of the principles. And therefore, as this is the fourth round, the emphasis is on the principle of kama, not on the principle of manas. Now, this is our real problem, of course, very definite problem, because while the emphasis in the round is on kama, in the fifth developmental stage, the emphasis is manas, but it's the manas aspect of kama, something I think we don't often think about, you see. But H.P.B. makes this clear in other of her writings, that this is therefore the real testing ground, because it is the manasic aspect of kama, and not until we really move that to the buddhic aspect of kama can we in some way develop this truly intuitive understanding, and really not until the fifth round will we be focused fully on manas and the various aspects of manas. And if we think the thing is tough now, you know, I hate to say it, but it's only going to get tougher. because imagine what it's going to be in the fifth developmental stage of the fifth round, when the emphasis is manas, you know. That's going to be something to deal with. Well, it may be in some ways easier, however. At least we'll have a little more experience, and that should help us somewhere along the way. But now, it can't be that. Now, therefore, Barborka suggests, and I think that he has some very persuasive arguments for his position, his conclusion that the earth chain is the fifth in a series of chain embodiments, and points, he suggests, to the undeniable fact that HPB indicated clearly that each time there is a rebirth of a planetary system, it is on a higher subplane. There are, of course, those who propose, and the diagram which I gave you from Gardner early on suggests, that our Earth chain is the fourth embodiment. That is the fourth embodiment within the Earth scheme. Barborka makes a very persuasive argument that it was really the fifth embodiment, and therefore this Brothers of the Fifth refers to that. Now, I merely present it. I think he is very persuasive. I think Barborka was undoubtedly one of our very best students, and without a question. I know how often either Virginia or I would write him when we were at Alcott, and of course Jeffrey came very frequently too to visit us there and gave many classes here at Crotona, and we would frequently write to him about some point, and he immediately knew the reference, and he could give you so much material. So I'm inclined to feel that he has a legitimate point, and that rather than this chain being the fourth chain in the series of chain embodiments, it may well be the fifth. And so we're in the fourth round of the fifth chain, which would put us a little bit further ahead than we thought, which is comforting in that respect. And I think, you know, it's always nice to know that you're really a grade ahead of where you thought you were. So there's a certain comfort, perhaps, in that. But it is a point that must not be overlooked. Now, what is important, of course, at this point, beyond that, is that at a time prior to the appearance of the first root race on this globe, at the beginning of the fourth round, there were no satisfactory rupas, forms, for the monads. And the next statement, of course, in Shloka 7, re-emphasizes this: no dwellings for the lives. To which HPB adds an interesting footnote explaining that by the term lives is meant the monads of the presentments of men of the third round, preceding round. It is these monads, in other words, who have accomplished three circuits of evolutionary development on each of the seven globes, or three complete rounds, including the seven major stages of evolutionary development on globe C, who are now awaiting entry onto globe D. They're in the wings and waiting for appropriate vehicles. Where are they, we may ask? You see, if I say in the wings, where are they? And HPB indicates the answer in a footnote to a phrase in the occult commentary. We've taken up that occult commentary and commented on it. And she uses in that commentary, the spheres of expectation is where they are, which she defines as intermediate spheres, wherein the monads, which have not reached nirvana, are said to slumber in unconscious inactivity between the mandantaras. So they're an intermediate. When we say spheres, do not, of course, immediately think of physical containers, you know, spherical in shape, but rather in realms of consciousness, which also take, by the very nature of the system, and this, of course, we had in the cosmogonic process, the circumgyratory, the very nature of the system tends to a spheroid condition, if you like, a spheroid state. And so this is where we were. So if you get tired, just remember you had an awfully long slumber once upon a time, because we didn't obviously reach nirvana in the third round, and we slumbered then in unconscious inactivity between manvantaras. Now, some of you may be more eager to experience that in the future than you are to remember it in the past, but it's rather nice to know that we get these nice long rest periods, you see, without having to worry about any rupas fit or unfit, as it were. Well, the final two sentences of Shloka 7 are again highly symbolic. Pure waters, not turbid, they must drink. Let us dry them. Now, here the pronouns are a bit confusing, for those who must drink are the monads who will continue their evolutionary cycle in this round in the human life wave, while the phrase, the reference, let us dry them, is obviously not to those monads, but to the process that is to be engaged in by these superior intelligences in drying up the waters, or more accurately, purifying the waters, a sort of absorbing. And it is said that this too is part of the sacrifice of intelligences at every single level, and I think we can see it in our own cases, if we will undertake this, that it's a process of absorbing into their own nature, these dhyanis, the turbidity, the pollution of the waters, and by an alchemical process returning them pure. And this, it is said, that we can even do at our particular level, that we can in some sense, that this is part of what has been called this Christos sacrifice, the whole process of taking into ourselves the pollution of the world, and through thought, through love, through the alchemical processes, returning it pure, sending it out pure. And I think this is a very marvelous thing, because again and again we see these very processes repeated at level after level, that we can, as it were, even now, take in a certain amount of the evil and send it out with love, with understanding, transmuted. It's a marvelous thing. And that is at that level, the higher level, if we may put it that way, what these dhyanis were about to engage in. Now, first we must remember, too, that the element principle of the third round was water. What you remember, the tattvas, you remember the list of tattvas. And so the third round principle is apas-tapa-tattva. Whereas for our round, the lowest, the principle is prithivi-tattva. So the drying has to be done in order for earth, as it were, the earth principle, to manifest itself. So a rupa or form in which water predominates would not be appropriate for a vehicle in the new round about to begin. And further, as water is correlate with desire, we can well understand that at this stage there is a turbid condition resulting from the old desire patterns, which symbolically, at least, were used by Earth in her production of such creatures as the watermen, terrible and bad. Quite obviously, then, help is needed if the globe itself is to be in a condition appropriate to receive the human life wave, and to enable that life wave to advance on its evolutionary journey. We may say, in other words, you see, that the dhyanis, these intelligences, I prefer to call them intelligences because they are intelligences, not obviously in physical form as we know it, but intelligences, intelligent entities, if you like, recognize their responsibility. And this indicates that they have reached a certain stage of development. There is, in other words, at every level, we want to put it this way, both the karma out of all of the past, but also then the realization of a dharma for the future. It is a marvelous, again we see this, and they recognize this. They don't like the forms, they're not fit rupas for our brothers. Now this means that they're doing it for someone else, not simply for themselves, you see. no fit roof is for our brothers of the fifth. Our flesh isn't there. You see, all of that. So, they realize their responsibility for seeing that things get off to a proper start. Let us dry the waters. Because now the old desire patterns, which have produced these ghastly forms, since it was all earth had to work with, as it were, now they are responsible to see that conditions are proper for the appropriate forms, rupas, to be built. This begins to give us, I think, a glimpse of what our responsibility is. Our responsibility even now to the animal kingdom, for example, and what our future responsibility will be, you see, when we reach that next stage of yonic intelligence towards the animal kingdom as it moves into human embodiment. That life wave moves into human embodiment. We're going to be involved, you know, in some of this. Maybe not drying up waters, but we're going to have to do something appropriate, you see. Well, finally, of course, help arrives after Earth has done all she can. Really desperate in her cry for help. Been told to see, you remember, what she can do on her own. She's thrown up forms, rupas, built of the cast-off and desire-laden stuff of previous rounds, and now can do no more. It's rather nice, of course, that the story has a happy ending. The regents of the earth, the higher intelligences, the Dhyanis, recognize the situation is not appropriate for their brothers to get involved in, and they therefore had better do something about it. And that, I think, is the wonderful thing. But again, we have a principle involved, and I call your attention to it, that the globe had to do everything it could to bring about the production of forms. It had to do everything it could before help arrived. And I think, again, a principle is involved. Often we have to do everything we can before help is given. This is, of course, the mystery of grace, if you like. But it's always true, isn't it? And sometimes it seems as though you go as far as you can and you're sort of left on your own and you're pushed to the limit. And then, suddenly, help comes in some form or other. Something comes. Again and again we see this happen throughout the process. Well, then the next series of shlokas, four shlokas, which I think we can look at really this morning, relate the activities of these intelligences, the regents, if you like, of Earth, and how Earth responds. I'm going to read all four of them, and then we'll look at them. The eighth shloka, the flames came, the fires with the sparks, the night fires and the day fires. Marvelous symbolism. We'll look at this. They dried out the turbid dark waters. With their heat they quenched them. The laws of the high, the Lama Yin of below, came. And so you notice that everything is arriving to help, you see. The laws, which are the high. Incidentally, this is why the capital of Tibet is Lhasa. It's the highest point, in case you haven't realized. It has the same word in it. And the Lama Yin from below. And they sort of meet, you see. And where they meet, that's us. One sense, you see. But we've got our job. All right, the laws of the high, the Lama Yin of below came. They slew the forms which were two and four-faced. They fought the goat men and the dog-headed men and the men with fishes' bodies. And then the ninth shloka continues it. Mother Water, the great sea, wept. She arose. She disappeared in the moon which had lifted her, which had given her birth. And the tenth, when they were destroyed, Mother Earth remained bare. She asked to be dried. And finally, the 11th, which HPB puts in the next stanza, but really belongs with this, the Lord of the Lords came. From her body he separated the waters, and that was heaven above, the first heaven. Marvelous, these four shlokas. And even without a thorough examination of all that is meant, we have a very graphic picture of the help that is given and understand, I think, at least intuitively, what transpired. This, I think, again points to the fact that in a system so magnificently coherent and unified, based on the fundamental proposition of a unitary reality, we see that every element in the great hierarchy of intelligences, every element in the entire system, whether participating in self-consciousness or not, has a role to play and serves the advance of the entire system. It's such a marvelously coherent system, it seems to me. The principle seems, indeed, to inhere in the very nature of the process that each being, on whatever step of the ladder he stands, aids those below and receives assistance from those above. Now, if you don't like above or below, it's a networking system. That seems to be the favorite word anyway these days. It's a networking system. It's an interlocking system. And always there has to be the aid and giving, both receiving and giving assistance. Again and again, this principle is illustrated throughout the secret doctrine and constitutes, in fact, the very ethical nature implied in the metaphysics which have been imparted to us. It is, above all, an ethical system. Now, one of the things that we have to note, too, and I think this corresponds with what today is known as the general systems theory. Many of us have heard Dr. Alistair Taylor in his visits here discuss the general systems theory at some length. Each further stage incorporates all previous stages so that it is not leaving some stage behind, but it is incorporating it in a new configuration. A new organization, but it is not by any means denigrating former units within it, subsidiary units, but rather seeing it as a whole. So with this thought in mind, we can examine, insofar as our time today allows, some of the meaning in these four shlokas that complete the story of the preliminary stages of this fourth round on Globe D. HPB, for example, explains the opening sentence of Shloka 8 in a very simple way. The flames are a hierarchy of spirits parallel to, if not identical with, the burning fiery seraphim mentioned by Isaiah. Those who attend, according to Hebrew theogony, the throne of the Almighty. Melha is the Lord of the flames. When he appears on earth, he assumes the personality of a Buddha, says a popular legend. He is one of the most ancient and revered laws, a Buddhist Saint Michael. Well, That's all she says about it, and the explanation is just about as esoteric as the shloka itself, except for the fact that it points to a class of beings and intelligences who appear to be intimately connected, again, with our planet. Melha, of course, is the Tibetan god of fire. And this is, you see, the process that is to be used is the drying out process. Well, what better to dry things out than fire? Isn't that right? I mean, it does dry things out. Sometimes more than one wishes, but it does dry things out. But we must remember that fire, as an element, or what is represented by fire, is the primal element, principal element of our round. Not necessarily the fire we know, but perhaps we could say the quality of fire. We've gone into this, so I'm not going to go into it again, and I've, of course, referred you to Janine Miller's excellent little work on the flame divine. I just remind you of a portion of a statement in the Mahatma Letters, in which the Master K.H. speaks of the primal igneous principle, and I suppose that's what it really is. The igneous principle is the ultimate cause of every phenomenal manifestation of fire on all the globes of the chain. So that while fire, in one sense, is one of the tattvas, it is the primary tattva within which all other tattvas are subsumed for our chain. And so, in one sense, while water was, I'm not going back to the first and second, but only the third and fourth, that's enough for us to deal with. This is the fire aspect of water, or what in one of the references in the Secret Doctrine she calls liquid fire. I don't know how you get that, but I mean that's the igneous principle of this. And this, of course, is the fire principle of Earth, which, of course, becomes much more visible then, ultimately, by this time in our whole evolution. And we can, I was going to say, deal with it. We had a difficult time in Ojai last summer dealing with it, but it, you know. But behind that, of course, is Akasha, which in its presentation as wind or air, Vayu, you remember, turned the tide of the fire here in Ojai, so it didn't sweep through it. So it's fortunate that there are some other elements involved. But underlying all, then, is this fire principle. And that is, again, called into activity at this stage. The flames, in other words, that came to see the situation on Globe D at the beginning of this round are also then the sparks of the creative fire, the original fire. They are, as the shloka tells us, the fires with the sparks, referring, if you like, to the creative outburst of that primordial dragon of wisdom which we met in shloka 1 of stanza 5 in the first series. Incidentally, when you put these shlokas together with the shlokas of the first series, you begin to see how the cosmogonic process is repeated again and again in the anthropogonic process. Marvelous. And the same thing. And you'll meet the same characters, you see, again and again. Now, in commenting on that shloka in stanza 5, H.P.B. indicated that the whole mystery of evolutionary creation is contained in the action of that energy or power which is called the dragon of wisdom and with which Fohat is associated. So you see, you can begin to see now how this is working out for our particular chain. that blazing divine dragon of wisdom, as earlier shlokas called it, as that primordial energy is referred to in the early shlokas, and which in the cosmogonic process itself set the whole universe turning in a circumgyrating manner, is here reflected then in the intelligences which in a sense embody the flames. You see? So you have both, again and again, you have both the principle and the intelligences which embody the principle. That we have to watch throughout. But H.P.B. adds further in her commentary, in volume 2, pages 63 and 64, besides a statement of a purely physical nature and belonging to the evolution of life on earth, there may be another allegorical meaning. I always like the way she says, there may be. You know darn well there is. Another allegorical meaning attached to this shloka, or indeed, as is taught, several. That is, several allegorical meanings. The flames or fires represent spirit, or the male element, and water, matter, or the opposite element. And here again, as she continues, we find in the action of the spirit slaying the purely material form a reference to the eternal struggle on the physical and psychic planes between spirit and matter, besides a scientific cosmic fact, she adds. Now, these fires, note, are also called the night fires and the day fires. This is an interesting point that I find it extremely interesting. Ashish points out in Man, Son of Man, that therefore they represent the creative energies of the visible and the invisible universe. The range of energies known to science are day fires, and the range of subtle energies hidden from sense perception are the night fires. So you have both. Now, in addition to these two kinds of fire, have their emotional connotations. Remember this, and I bring this up because this fourth round is concerned with kama, you see. The entire subject can be viewed, in other words, from a psychological point of view. The day fires, then, represent the intellectual modes of knowing, the sharpness of day, which distinguishes, which analyzes. So it's the intellectual modes of knowing, while the night fires represent those cohesive modes of feeling. Ashish describes this very well. As purely emotional modes, the night fires draw things together into a unity. They are attractive forces of love and affinity, while the day fires are the forces of repulsion, disgust, hatred, anger, and opposition. However, we need to take care on this matter, because we need to recognize that in one sense, the dark side, the shadow side, is represented by the day fires, whereas the light side is represented by the night fires. It's an interesting reversal. Manifestation means the birth of opposites, through the polarization of the original one. And we have to, therefore, accept the separative forces of the day as much of divine origin as we may long for the unity of the night. Both are of divine origin. They are the two poles, the day fires and the night fires, of the flames, of this principle of fire. Ashish puts it, without hostility, anger, and pain, there could have been no manifest universe, for there could have been no separation of one aspect of being from another. And I think this begins to be reflected in a variety of ways. For example, a commentary in Light on the Path, you may recall, points out that the vices of men are as much steps on the ladder as are the virtues. Both are necessary.
Justification.
I don't think we should see it necessarily as a justification, although we can, yes, it is a nice justification. But it's a recognition that both are essential. They are what I call the two poles of a single continuum, just as the continuum of temperature has the two poles of hot and cold, which are not opposites, but polarized aspects of one continuum for manifestation. And so we have to watch this, and I think it's rather interesting, and I like that statement of Ashish's, therefore, without hostility, anger, and pain, without the fall, if you like, you say, there to this in a moment, so that combined with the creative potencies of the flames, they bring the globe to a stage at which it can sustain the beings that will inhabit it, so that there is both the formative side and the creative side. This, what you may call spirit and matter, if you like. Ashish puts it, the desire waters are seized and built up into the structures of the new earth, the great earthy wheel of the universe. The waters, turbid with old human and animal desire patterns, are thus dried out. And in the process of this drying, the wheel of Mother Earth becomes bare or outwardly apparent, while the waters disappear from being absorbed by the formative powers of the creative intelligence or moon, the Lord of the Lords. Now, the process, in fact, is explained so beautifully by Ashish that I really would like to quote him rather at length. I hope you don't mind, but I think he explains it so well. The laws, these laws of the high, are the conscious powers of the various levels, that is, the various tattvas, the various fields or spheres of experience. They are not persons, as we understand personality, though because every power in the universe has subscribed something, whether to man's physical form or to his mental-emotional makeup, they are sometimes represented in human form. And indeed they are, when Barborka refers to them exoterically as classes of celestial beings. In many of the mandalas of Tibet, Tibetan Buddhism, and in many of the illustrations, you know, you get these tremendous number of representations in human form, sometimes demons, sometimes angelic, and so on, but tremendous number if you look at the Tibetan Buddhist mandalas and scrolls and so on. There they all are congregated because they depicted them, and they became really as entities almost in human form, because this appears to be the form towards which everything tends one way or another. So they are represented that way. But as Ashi says, perhaps the closest we can get to experiential knowledge of them is by abstracting, even this is difficult, abstracting our powers of perception from our perception, our powers of action from our act. or acts. Can you abstract the power of perception from perception itself? The power to act from the act itself. These faculties, he suggests, belong to and in some sense are the law, these intelligences. They are the cosmic hierarchies of conscious powers, intense concentrations of the powers of knowing, powers that demand clarity of outline, distinctness of form, exactitude of number, certainty of perception. And so they then take form. They clothe themselves in form. That's page 70 in Man, Son of Man. In fact, this whole chapter, there are two chapters in Man, Son of Man dealing with this that are really tremendous and need to be studied. One is chapter 5 and chapter 6, both in Man, Son of Man. So full of helpful understandings from the point of view of consciousness, the psychological aspect. So he says, contrast these precise powers with the shifting, vaguely diffuse, all over at once desire of the sea. And we understand the nature of the drying that has to take place. Excuse me, it's a good thing Matthew puts this up here now and then. Mercurial mind must have a stable vehicle, one that will obey the will. And that demands a degree of separation between earth and water, the material outwardness and the living desire, to allow conscious discrimination between the realities of sense experience and the realities of desire images. So you see, in a sense, this process is repeated again and again. We have to get dried out now and then, if you want to put it that way. And we, from the over, you know, we get this marvelous sort of feeling that overcomes us. And then we dry it out by making it precise, by defining it, by, you know, this is what the poet does. It's what the writer does. It's what the artist does again and again. Isn't it, Jason? You're a poet, Virginia. Isn't that true? You get that sensation, and the drying out is getting it precisely defined, or as much as you can. Mm-hmm. So consequently, we must remember that every material form has its subtle or desire component. And so the flames must be accompanied by the laws and Lama Yin, who are responsible, they become responsible for the dissolution or slaying of the forms built of past desires, the dregs of our own past, which have taken shape in these monstrous creations of watermen, goatmen, men with fishes' bodies, and so on. And we can, in other words, take these shlokas as literal descriptions of the early stages of our globe at the beginning of this fourth round, or, this is what I prefer, we can seek to understand the psychological truths which are embedded in the mystical language of the shlokas. And we can see that the process is repeated and repeated and repeated, it, with variations, you know, theme with variations, if you like. It's to this, of course, that Ashish points, and I think reading his commentary helps us to see that the outer events that are referred to are still alive within us. Because, as I said in referring it to the general systems theory, all of the previous organizations at any level, if you like, are subsumed and incorporated within the organizations that come on further. And so we are the third round men, if you like, but now with something else. But that is still within us. And we can see this, for example, in Shloka 9, which is phrased in highly symbolic language. Mother Water, the great sea, wept. She arose. She disappeared in the moon which had lifted her, which had given her birth. Now, while HPB in her commentary, of course, tells us that this is an evident reference to tidal action in the early stages of the history of our planet in its fourth round, we have to also recognize the validity of the fact that we've just pointed out that water element, apas tattva, lessened, as that lessened, the earth element or principle, prithivi tattva, became more dominant during this round. At the same time, the entire process, we can understand it in another dimensionality of meaning, if you like, that from the viewpoint of this very early period, the early verses, the earth is only vaguely, you can say, dreamily objective. Images drawn from the past blend with images from an unrealized future. There's a kind of shifting, a kaleidoscope of images. But nothing achieves the relatively stable being of our stable state of our waking experience. To put it one way, and as Ashish does, on the one hand, the mud is too wet. On the other, the potter is only dreaming of pots. It's a marvelous phrase. The materiality of form has to reach a point where the form, the matter, will be susceptible of definition by the differentiating powers of the mind. So what we may call the sea of fluid energies has to be distinguished from the great mother, the ocean, the matrix, the abstract principle of unlimited possibility. Mother Water then arose. She disappeared in the moon. Now, the moon at this point is not simply referring to the third round, which was the previous chain, not the round, but the previous chain, the moon chain. But we have to be very careful because there are many, many meanings to these terms. And moon, in this context, is the great wisdom being, the universal mind, the matrix, the mother. So one has to be, she disappeared in that which had lifted her, which had given her birth. So space, then, Mother Water, the great sea, wept. Space becomes filled with drops, the weeping of this primordial matrix are the separate entities, the drops, the great sea wept. This subtle sea is in some sense dried up or drained in the process of building higher degrees of form. And so the ideas, the separate ideas, the tears, if you like, as separate ideas in the universal mind, the wisdom being, the universal matrix, the mother, the moon, these become clothed in material representations, first as the point-like sparks of the lower levels with their surrounding sea of energy relationships, and then as the increasingly complex forms build up out of the same sea. We have the great symbol then, which is implied in this shloka, that the dragon of wisdom devours its own tail, returns, rose, lifted up to that which gives it birth. you see, which had lifted her, which had given her birth. The great dragon of wisdom devours its own tail, the Ouroboros of the Greek mythology. And the entire development then, in its symbolic representation, continues then in Shloka 10, when they, that is the rupas, these rupas, these watermen and so on, were destroyed, Mother Earth remained bare. She asked to be dried. Now you may say the drying has already taken place, but now she is asking to be really separated, because only in that condition can she be fructified with the new life wave. Again, in HPB, in her commentary, hints at both what we can call the literal meaning in terms of the beginning of this round and the mystical or psychological meaning. In the first sense, as HPB tells us, the meaning is simply that, in a very simple statement, the time for its incrustation had arrived. That is, for Earth's incrustation. In the second, more profound meaning, she speaks of water as the symbol of the female element, the universal matrix, whose sun is Cupid or Eros. And so again we have our good friend Fohat. She says, hence Cupid or love in his primitive sense is Eros, the divine will, or desire of manifesting itself through visible creation. She asked to be dried. She, therefore, within Earth, you see, she had asked previously, you remember, she had appealed for some forms, and she was told, get back and do what you can do, you see, take care of it yourself. She creates these forms. They are not very, all she has to work with is the desire elements of the past, so she comes up with these horrible creatures. But now she asks to be dried, which again is for definition, desire of manifesting itself through visible creation. And so HPB adds, thence Fohat, the prototype of Eros, becomes on Earth the great power life electricity, or the spirit of life-giving. And HPB adds, let us remember the Greek theogony and enter into the spirit of its philosophy. We are taught by the Greeks that all things, gods included, owe their being to the ocean and his wife Tethys, the latter being Gaia, the earth or nature. But who is ocean? HPB says, ocean is the immeasurable space, which is the deity, and Tethys is not the earth, but primordial matter in the process of formation. So one sees it again. What does all this mean? Well, simply that, as Ashish points out, we all have the power of seeing pictures when we look into a fire or up at the clouds or even at the ripples on a lake. Images arise within matter itself in its fluidic state. How many times have you looked at the clouds as they float and you see this or that, you know, you see gophers and rabbits and plants and all sorts of things, elephants, all the rest, don't you, in the clouds. What the images lack is objectivity. And this is supplied for us by psychic projection, just as a similar process takes place at this early stage of the Earth history. The function of the law of the high and the lama yin of below, of these shlokas becomes that of giving objectivity through their own embodied powers. The laws, then, are the differentiated powers that call out the hosts of forms from the subtle vapors of the matrix. The multitude of embodied powers are the lama yin. So the law represent, then, conscious power from above, While the Lama Yin stand for or embody the formative desire from below, and in between stands consciousness, represented by man, or perhaps more properly, the archetype of the Anthropos. That divine will, which HPB terms Eros, that desire of manifesting itself through visible creation, is of course within each one of us, and is a power of the laws of the high, but equally there is within us the Lama Yin of below, who may be either gods or devils in accordance with our use of the formative powers of our desires. And Ashish gives a very graphic illustration of the way in which these powers may be turned in one direction or another. So I'm using his. He says, let us take, for example, our power of taste. Is this a snare of the devil, luring us to self-indulgence in gluttony, or a gift of the divine, a rational guide to our choice of diet, a protection against unwholesome food, a stimulant to digestive secretions, and a mode of the divine bliss? The Lama Yin are in fact what we make of them, gods if we can see their divinity, devils if we do not. So it's not in the power of taste that anything either wonderful or dreadful happens. It's what we do with that power, isn't it? Either become gluttons or eat properly in a balanced diet and so on, and you know, live on to a healthy old age, whatever. So if we can understand the nature of these two great hierarchies of intelligences which are met in us, the laws of the high and the Lama Yin of below, we can also understand what is meant by the slaying of the desire-bred forms that have infested the matrix. These watermen, terrible and bad, goat men, men with fishes' bodies, and so on. So long as we fail to control our lower natures, we shall be the slaves of fluctuating desires, and our minds will be filled with their images, goats, dogs, and fishes, symbols of our instinctive libidinous desires, which we first must slay and then prevent their further arising by dissecting and analyzing their nature with the keen and aseptic blade of the intellect. So it's all within us. So it is for us to dry out the turbid dark waters of our own psyche, which we so freely project outwards onto others and onto situations. We clear our desire nature of its turbidity and provide pure waters from which the immortal within us must drink for proper sustenance. For that, all meditation practices, countless, constant recollectedness is needed. For, of course, again, I'd like to quote Ashish, the universe around us is a blend of subjective and objective elements of experience, an intermingling of the descending and ascending components of being. From above, the conscious, radiant, predominantly subjective powers are descending, while from below, the blind, dark, cohesive, objective elements are rising like a thick mist called out from the wet earth by the power of fire. So it is all there within us. Thus, the distinguishing mark of our fourth round here on Globe D is the power of objectivizing all that is within the universal mind. At the same time, we have to learn to stand aside, as it were, from the desire-laden waters that would engulf us. Learning to, or rather perhaps paying, the price of suffering detachment from self-assertive desire. Again, to quote Ashish, within each one of us there stands an immortal son of wisdom, the knower of our memories, the experiencer of our desires, the actor of our acts. He alone is deathless. Neither the fires of the creative outpouring nor the all-absorbing waters of the matrix can destroy him, for he is a son of the fire itself, a son of wisdom. Marvelous statement. Now, to know this, and to know it fully wholly, appears to be the reason for the separation that comes in Shloka 11. Symbolically, of course, given us, the Lord of the Lords came from her body, that is, from the earth. He separated the waters, and that was heaven above, the first heaven. Very reminiscent, of course, of Genesis, isn't it? Very reminiscent. Mystical indeed, as HPB tells us. And she refers both to the Puranic story of creation and to that story given in the first chapter of Genesis. And as she points out later, volume 2, page 488, referring to the work of the creative potencies, the Elohim, in the Genesis story, they separated the upper manifested heaven or plane of consciousness from the lower or terrestrial plane, the to us eternal and immutable eons from those periods that are in space, time, and duration, heaven from earth, the unknown from the known. The interesting thing is that it really is a double heaven that is produced. A double heaven, as HPB points out. And so it is our unique function, through the development of consciousness, through all its stages, earth is prepared now, to unite the two, or double heavens, as HPB calls them, to unite the eternal with the temporal, heaven with earth, the unknown with the known. And that, of course, is the task which we undertake through the developmental stages, which, of course, is what we have to take up next in our study. But now we've got the whole system ready. The globe is prepared. But we begin to see how this reflects in ourselves. It again and again, and that's why I wanted to bring in so much of its psychological meaning. Well, this leaves us some time for questions, discussion. Bill.
On the one hand, we're presented with a lot of forms. On the other hand, we're told that everything is myopic. And still on the other hand, we're told that as below, so above. So how do you reconcile those?
Well, you have to remember, first of all, that when it's said that there are a lot of forms, it is not form as we know it today. Now, one of the very difficult points, I suppose, for us to ever visualize or imagine is form which does not participate in physicality. But form is a principle. And this, when there is a manifested universe, everything from the highest on to the physical is, now often we call the three higher planes, for example, Atma Buddhi Mana says, Arupa. From the point of view of the highest Dhyan Chohan, says HPB, they are Rupa. Everything has a form principle involved in it. From our level, it is formless. But one has to also see that from the point of view of the highest intelligences, everything from Atma to physical, to Stula Sharira, has within it a form-building principle. And that's what's involved here. So it is forms. It is, now form, however, is also, and this is why Ashish, I think, is very good in saying, can you separate, can you abstract the power of perception from perception? Because within the form-building principle is present always its own energy, its own dynamism, if you like, its own desire, its own creative potency, however you want to explain it, you see. And following the whole cosmogonic process, that is a potency which moves in, we're told, a circumgyratory manner. And I think this is borne out with the fact that today we know that space is curved. By its very nature, there is a curvature to the continuum. This, indeed, I think is one of the points that one has to realize is fundamental to the whole principle that we know as karma, which is the principle of action itself. That it is always circular, that is to say, it always is a returning on its axis to that point from which it went forth. It may not, I don't want to get off into that. That's a whole other subject. But it seems to me, therefore, Bill, that we have to recognize that we're not dealing with form in its physicality, but with this principle which has within it also its own energy, its own desire. Therefore, always moves to build something at its own level. And therefore, the earth at this stage, in this very watery stage, in this very... Now, from the point of view, you say, at the same time, all of this is Maya. This is its very principle. Maya is its very energy. It is its own Shakti. You see, when we remember Maya, which we usually translate as illusion, which is the worst possible translation, I think, in spite of the fact that HPB uses it, she, of course, explains why she uses it. She explains what it means, what underlies it. This is its principle of definition. And the moment you define, the moment you bring into objectivity at whatever level, you have only brought about an appearance of that which is underlying it, that which is essential. And it is that appearance. Maya is its own Shakti. This is why Maya is called a Shakti in the Hindu system. It's its own energy. It is indeed related very closely, therefore, to Fohat as the power, as the potency. It is that which produces illusion. It is not illusion, but that which is which produces illusion. This is why also the very word Maya is also related to our English word magic. And both come from the same root, because it is a magical play. It is the use, it is a magic which brings this about at every level. And it is related to that. And the Magi were those who were proficient in the use of this Shakti, our wisdom. Therefore called the wise men, because to know how to manipulate form and energy or dynamism within it is indeed to be a magician and to be a wise man.
The term of water men,
mm-hmm,
and goat men, mm-hmm, is a bit confusing, perhaps, rather unfortunate, because they could not have been men.
No, that's right.
Because the runners were still...
That's right. But they were... I think this is true. It's too bad they're called water men and goat men and men with fish's bodies, because they could not... certainly Manas was not active.
was not activated.
Yes.
But then neither was Manas activated until the middle of the third root race, and yet we talk of these entities, this life wave that entered in the preliminary stages and even through the first 2.5 root races to the middle of the third, we speak of men. And they were not in that sense, because only with the incarnation of the Manasaputras to be in the middle of the third root race does man as we know him emerge.
I take it that the men with the goat men with men faces were some kind of a thought form projected from, say, globe C.
From a previous round on the,
on the
globe D.
Yes.
You see, because the reawakening of globe D is also, you see, what globe D was in the third round. And therefore, this is all of the desire-laden matter, not only that has come from the preceding globes, but also from globe D in its preceding rounds, and which has lain dormant, and now that which Earth, the sentient Earth, has to deal with, to build. So I wouldn't say only from globe C, but reawakened from the earlier first, second, third rounds on globe D.
This is why it seems a good idea to translate Diane into intelligences,
yes,
rather than laws.
I think so.
We had an English member who admitted after the class that she thought of them as dukes marching to the Mr. Abbey in Birmingham.
I think that that's very true. I think it's much better to use the term intelligences. Now, intelligences of various levels of front.
It seems ironic that in our present stage of evolution, using the word man,
mm-hmm,
we cannot comprehend anything without some form.
That's right.
Because we have, the moment we think we know it, it takes form.
It takes form. That's
and
right.
We create the form to suit our ability to comprehend.
Absolutely. Oh, always, yes. And this is why the whole process is repeated in us of psychic projection, which is indeed the process that is throughout the entire system, is one of psychic projection, and we continue to do it until we have to eat our own projections, as it were. As Dr. Panikkar on Saturday used that marvelous phrase, and I think it was so wonderful because it's so true. We have to assimilate this. We take it back, and this is he was marvelous on that. I thought that point on Saturday.
Is there any connection between the goat men and whatnot between Greek myths?
I think there is. And we find, you see, HPB points out, we find it in the Babylonian myths. We find it in the myths of Chaldea. We find it in the Puranas, of course, of India. We certainly find it in the Greek myths, these early creatures, the satyrs and the all of these creations. These.
Yeah, especially the dragons and all.
Yes. And dragons, of course, are in every myth. Chinese and every myth.
The unicorn.
The unicorn. Oh, yes, very much so. And that's why I've frequently said, as you know, that someday I'm going to be brave enough to do a whole series on the esotericism in these great myths and try to bring them together, because I think they're tremendous.
Don't wait too long.
Maybe I'm getting a little ahead of where we are right now, but I'd like to ask you, when we speak of the higher laws, is there a connection between them and the fallen angels?
There probably is. There must be to the Luciferian evolution. I'm sure that there is.
I'm thinking of this comment about we don't understand anything until we see it in form. this is true even of abstract ideas.
Mm-hmm.
We don't understand them until we frame them in words.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
once we have framed an idea in words, we understand it better.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
Okay. Otherwise, it's just a vague something.
Mm-hmm. This is
so
why
it is.
I think this is why anyone who has done any teaching realizes that it helps you so much to define your own understandings. I'm sure Diana's found this in her series on Fridays in discussing karma. It really helps, and I think the greatest privilege of all is to have an opportunity to share these things. I'm not really teaching them, but to share them, because it defines it for me. It makes it, to me, it becomes exciting.
On the pre-primary level,
mm-hmm.
how do you feel about Borka?
Hmm? Bob Borka? A person, but in the first volume, very early on in the introduction, I think it is a footnote, she points out that this is the Sensar term, it's related to a Chinese term, a Tibetan term, all of this cognate with this root word of nya, which is a knowing. Those, therefore, these are stanzas, these are statements of that arose out of concentrated attention. This, of course, is what the Vedas are. And this is also related to did to see. You see, those who saw, those who heard the great hymns of creation. That's the rishis who gave us the Vedas. So these are the concentrations. To listen is to concentrate. To listen closely. And that, again, Dr. Panikkar spoke of that, listening. One has to listen, and then one hears. It's a model.
Coming back to the dragons, what always fascinated me was, what is behind the idea of Siddhi slaying the dragon, the fiery dragon,
mm-hmm.
and then being bathed in his blood,
mm-hmm.
and then becoming somebody who cannot be killed?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to
almost all, yes, almost all myths with regard to dragons have dragons breathing fire.
Yeah. But then the blood that makes him.
Yes, and the blood, of course, again, blood is a very occult symbol for the life fluid which is present. It is the life fluid. The fire, of course, is the dynamism, that which makes the motor of the dragon run. You see? And it is a release of the energy, and then to bathe in the very life principle of wisdom itself, the dragon as wisdom, the dragon as the concentration of energy which can moves upon the earth. Sometimes, of course, there are flying dragons. In some myths we have flying dragons, but most of the time they are earthbound because they are part of our system. It is wisdom incarnate for our particular humanity on earth. To kill the dragon is to release the energy, to bathe in its blood is to absorb its life, the very life power of that wisdom. And therefore, once you have done that, you are immortal.
Often also they're guarding something.
Yes, they're usually guarding a treasure. Usually guarding a treasure. Mm-hmm.
We had a film on Swedenborg last night. Would you give us your opinion of Swedenborg?
Well, he was certainly a great mystic. He was not only a great scientist, as the film showed, and certainly someone who had a profound knowledge. He was a very brilliant man. Wrote a number of books. And he was a profound mystic, a great visionary, a tremendous visionary. His vision of the after-death states has certainly been borne out in recent years by their studies and near-death experiences, haven't they? The long tunnel of light and so on, all of that. I'm not that familiar with all of Swedenborg's writings by any means. I had enough to do to read the secret doctrine. I admit that I will say, oh, something you haven't read, it's true. I really am not that familiar with all of Swedenborg's writings to be able to make a full commentary, but I think he was a great mystic and a great visionary. Certainly was someone who was a person very true to himself, was true to his own vision, and I think that's the basic thing that one has to, the man who would know, he did want to know, but he was true to that vision. Nothing shook him. And I think that's a very wonderful thing.
There's a story related to him in his ability of clairvoyance.
Mm-hmm.
He was addressing a class at a university. And he pulled out his watch and said, at this moment, there's a fire going on next to my home.
Yes.
And that was some 300 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was later verified that the time and place was accurate.
That was in the film, too, last night. That was shown in the film.
And of course,
he predicted the exact time of his own death.
Mind you, anyone nowadays would say, "Oh well, he lay down and died psychosomatically," auto suggestion.
Yes,
that's the problem.
I know that often is true, but he was clairvoyant. He certainly.
I know a lady who read in her own stars. She was an excellent astrologer.
Mm-hmm.
She read of her own death, and she lay down and died, and the doctors were absolutely mystified.
As to why
she became a case in Auckland.
Well, thank you very much. Our time is up, and I hope you've enjoyed the series as much as I have.